Welcome to the Damage Report. I am Jordan Ewell, filling in for John Iadarola. Joining me today, unfortunately, is Brett Ehrlich.
Yeah, unfortunately, on opposite day. You know what I mean?
Yeah. How are you, Brett?
I'm so good. I know that John's not here and he's probably not watching, but and wouldn't it be great if we did such reckless activity on this show when he's gone that we got it canceled? Like, what if we just ripped 8 shots in a row? I'm not saying that we're going to rip 8 shots in a row, but I'm just saying, like, what if we did rip 8 shots in a row?
Oh my God.
Goodness. Yeah. One of these is Gatorade. Oh, wasn't that one? Wasn't that one? Oh. I'm out. Just kidding. 5. Jordan.
Keep going. Keep going.
Got. 7. 7 get the show canceled shots. Got. 8.
Do you have a lime or anything?
There we go.
We got the lime. Oh, what a performance.
More like the liver damage report. Bangarang!
I do hope John saw that. Just so he knows the show is in good hands. We will protect you. We'll take care of it.
Yeah, that'll take the edge off the coke I did. Goodness.
Got a big show today. Do you want to get into it, Brett?
Yeah, sure. Why not? Whether I can't remember or not, you've been more than kind. Fair.
All right, take a look at this.
I filed the motion to vacate today, but it's more of a warning and a pink slip. I respect our conference. I paid all my dues to my conference. I'm a member in good standing, and I do not wish to inflict pain on our conference and to throw the house in chaos. But this is basically a warning, and it's time for us to go through the process, take our time, and find a new Speaker of the House that will stand with Republicans and our Republican majority instead of standing with the Democrats.
We are so back. The circus of the Republican Party continues. Marjorie Taylor Greene has filed a motion to oust Mike Johnson from the speakership amid anger about the government funding bill that was just passed in the House. It's important to note that Greene isn't yet forcing to vote to remove Johnson as speaker. A source close to the conversations told CNN that a number of fellow GOP lawmakers were trying to convince the Georgia Republican not to bring the motion. But after she filed it, she was swarmed by her Republican colleagues. Two of the lawmakers who were there, GOP reps Barry Loudermilk and Kat Kamick, were observed to be in an extended conversation with Greene. She said, "We need a Speaker of the House who will fight to secure America's border at all cost. Not one that passes a $1 trillion Democratic wish list that continues the border invasion, funds the weaponized government, and breaks our own conference rules. I'm done with this one." The House would have to consider Greene's motion within 2 legislative days after she is recognized. The chamber heads to recess for 2 weeks on Friday afternoon. The current 1,012-page bill provides $886 billion in funding for the Defense Department, including a raise for U.S. troops. It also covers agencies ranging from the Department of Homeland Security, the IRS, the DOJ, along with Treasury and State Departments. But conservatives said that the legislation was insufficiently conservative, citing the $1.2 trillion price tag. They were particularly infuriated to see $200 million in fresh funding for the new FBI headquarters in Maryland, as well as earmarked funding requested by senators for LGBTQ centers. Representative Eric Swalwell of California said, "Mark my words, Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene will not move to throw Speaker Johnson out. She's all talk. Remember when she promised a vote on Biden's impeachment? I work in professional wrestling. These people aren't serious." Brett, I want to bring you in here. Do you think this is just a publicity stunt from Marjorie Taylor Greene, or will we see a process similar to the one that Matt Gaetz led to oust Kevin McCarthy?
I think this is great because, like, she's kind of doing an impression of Matt Gaetz. And the margin is even smaller than it was before. Do they have the votes to hold on to the speakership? Is it still that precarious that you can just like basically show up and be like, let's get a new one? And if you got four friends, you can just get a new one. My favorite thing, I do think she actually, she wants this kind of power more than she wants a new speaker. She wants to be the one that makes this stuff happen. She wants to be famous for fighting for something. She doesn't understand the totality of what it is to make laws in America and how those laws affect people. She's essentially like the kid at the food court in the mall that's like, well, for dinner, I'd like a bunch of cotton candy. And there's a bunch of grownups around being like, we can't just have cotton candy. But I have to give a hat tip to Eric Swalwell, who's kind of like the unsung funny guy of the House of Representatives. He definitely tweets stuff like this all the time. And when he does, it's part like, I am insulting you and calling you weak, and part reverse psychology and like a dare saying like, you ain't got the guts, hoping that person will jump off the bridge.
Yeah, so much of the support for Marjorie Taylor Greene comes from people outside of her district. I mean, she herself is somebody who got radicalized and got involved in politics after being just kind of a Facebook MAGA poster. She got involved with people who were into conspiracy theories and right-wing fringe politics. That prompted her to run for Congress. That's the game that she knows. It's just viral attention and stunts. So her doing this, I think, is not really built on any principle. We did a story a couple days ago on the main show that she will speak out against these spending bills, but then turn around in her district, celebrate the money that's coming to her district as if she did it when she voted against it. She doesn't really care. She doesn't have any real firm beliefs beyond broad internet conservative. And I think what we're seeing here is another desperate attempt for publicity, hopefully to get some small dollar donations from people around the country. It's pure nonsense.
But I don't know. Yeah, there's two kinds of things, it seems like, that create representatives in the Congress. One is the extensive, think Koch brothers, billionaire farm system that goes and finds talent that will be good at giving lip service to populist right wingers and actually only deliver the kinds of legislation that benefits the billionaires. But this other one is just someone who discovered that they can be big on social media and get elected. Like they can get popular by being terrible. And so she, you know, you have hundreds and 400 and something legislators in Congress that are in the House of Representatives. A small percentage of them are going to be Marjorie Taylor Greene. And I think what ends up happening after a while is if you have someone like Marjorie Taylor Greene who's not like really paying attention to how annoying she's being to people that aren't really paying attention, they don't understand how chaotic and unstable it makes a lot of people in America feel when the Republicans are like ousting speakers of the House when they have absolute control over keeping one. You know, like the folks in the middle who are the ones who are going to really determine this election, the ones who are like, Trump's enough. Like the activities like this are going to make them go like, Republicans by and large are enough. And I'm going to follow Nikki Haley towards supporting Biden.
Yeah, I think there's an opportunity for Democrats here to lean into this rather than just dismissing it as calling it a circus, which it is. Any objective observer would realize this is just a publicity stunt, but lean into it. Just let them hash this out. Show your voters, show the base, show the American public, this is who this party has become. And when you have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene, like Matt Gaetz, forcing them to focus on these things instead of doing anything that could benefit people, instead of like they have no real accomplishments that they pioneered, that they pushed forward. Anything that's really passed has been from the Biden administration or must pass spending bills. The Republicans have only been focused on things like this. So push it, lean into it, let them go explain to voters why they've had multiple different speakers over the past year and a half that's come this November.
I mean, is it just that they want like border stuff? Is that really all it comes down to? Because there is an argument for like your average person doesn't really know what the government does. They just know that it's failing at stuff they're bad at. Like someone who lives in Ohio and is like, I love America. I hate the government. I need something to blame for why I'm upset. Is probably just gonna be like, it's immigrants, man. And so they'll gravitate toward the person who's doing something because they don't like immigrants. Like there's so many people who vote based on immigration in areas where it doesn't affect them at all. That like maybe that's who it appeals to. And they're, you know, obviously trying to rile up the base to maybe counteract all the people that they're losing by being so damn annoying.
Got to go on to our next story. It's a big one. Take a look at this.
The property that you alluded to, Mar-a-Lago, potentially that could be something that could be sold quickly. I think the valuation is something in the hundreds of millions. And I think there could be a buyer for something like that. So I think that would be the best case scenario as to proper if he's trying to sell quickly. I would encourage that.
So, all right, now that's $240 million estimated. I mean, who knows? You know, he's a desperate seller in this case. Someone picks up the phone and makes that call this week. So I don't know what it'd be. That's still half right of what it would be.
It is crunch time for Trump, with time running out on Monday to pay the $464 million levied against him. He could find himself unburdened by one of his most prized properties after Mar-a-Lago if he continues to be unable to make bond. Should he be unable, New York's Attorney General Letitia James is fully ready to seize what the state is owed. Documents show that the New York Attorney General Letitia James has started preparing to seize his family's hallowed grounds at Seven Springs, the billionaire tycoon's Bruce Wayne-like mansion nestled on 212 acres of dense woods and rolling hills. James quietly filed judgments in Westchester County on March 6th against the former president, his eldest sons Don Jr. and Eric, and several of their companies just as they unsuccessfully tried to stall the case. Two employees at the clerk's office explained that the move effectively means that the AG has placed liens on any and all properties that belong to Trump, Don Jr., Eric, and the Trump Organization, and two of their other listed corporate entities. The blanket lien now in place means that if Trump tried to sell any property in Westchester County, a title search will reveal that there is a $500 million judgment hanging over his head. Trump has one important property in that area, Trump National Westchester in Seven Springs, which sits on 212 acres. Seven Springs was just one of several real estate ventures that factored into the AG's bank fraud case against the former president. For years, Trump failed in his attempts to develop the property into a luxury golf course and slice up the land into expensive mansions for sale. In the end, Trump opted to donate much of the land to conservation, but investigators said he snagged an unfairly large charitable tax write-off by overestimating the value of the land. That just seems so out of character for Trump. I mean, what do you think, Brett? Is he going to lose his property? Are you happy he's losing it? Do you think there's any risk politically if he loses these properties? What do you make of this story?
That's so much to owe tomorrow. You know what I mean? Like, that's so much to owe tomorrow. But he's this billionaire and that's his brand. It's an installment, right? Doesn't he owe an installment of it? Like, you can't be like, hey, give me $500 million tomorrow. But there's a part of me that I can't deny feels a little bad for them. Because it's like, they're going to take Seven Springs. I love the idea of a mansion that's nestled in 212 acres. Like, what does that even mean? Like, you can't, how do you nestle a mansion? The guy committed fraud. You know, he defrauded the taxpayers like us. We have to pay the money we owe to the government. If you are found liable of some tax cheating, then you face jail time and huge fines, which you have to pay or you have to suffer the consequences. If you miss a car payment, they're gonna take the car back. Like, the repo man has come to reap what Trump himself has sown. This went through the legal process. You can't say necessarily as freely as a lot of people on Fox are saying, like, they're just coming after Trump. They went through the process. he thought he was immune to stuff like this, and he wasn't. So like, if you got to sell Seven Springs, you got to sell Seven Springs. Like, your chickens came home to roost, man. I'm sorry.
And God, 2015, 2016, I miscalculated my taxes and the IRS sent me a letter like, hey, you owe a couple $100. And they sent me like repeated letters, like even down to the smallest amount, you got to pay what you owe. But this guy thinks that he can get out of it. He's going to try cooking the books, but it is enjoyable to watch someone finally who's wealthy and cheated the system get their comeuppance. There's another angle of this that I want to get to. So Trump has a couple novel ways of how to pay his mounting legal bills across his many, many cases. To start, let's jump back 2 weeks ago when this was what Trump said, Trump and his team said on the topic.
A resolution to formally ban Trump from spending RNC money on legal fees never saw a vote. Republicans instead take Trump at his word.
The Trump campaign has confirmed that indeed they have no plans to spend any RNC dollars on it and will not do it. And we appreciate that very much.
Anyone who gives any money to the RNC, can you assure them or not that nothing will be used for the former president's legal proceedings?
Look, the president's campaign has made it perfectly clear that they are not going to ask for any of those legal funds to be coming out of the RNC. So that's a done deal.
You are never going to guess what happened next. That's right. Trump is going back on his word. What happened in between? Laura Trump became co-chair of the RNC. Now, some details. Donald Trump's new joint fundraising agreement with the RNC directs donations to his campaign and a political action committee that pays the former president's legal bills before the RNC gets a cut, according to a fundraising invitation obtained by the AP. Trump has invited high dollar donors to Palm Beach, Florida, for an April 6th fundraiser that comes as his fundraising is well behind President Joe Biden's and National Democrats. The invitation's fine print says donations to the Trump 47 committee will first be used to give the maximum amount allowed under federal law to Trump's campaign. Anything left over from the donation next goes toward a maximum contribution to Save America. And then anything left from there goes to the RNC and then to state political parties. Trump's campaign has an insane defense to this. The Trump campaign noted that Save America spends on expenses other than legal fees and that donors to the April fundraiser who contribute the suggested $814,600 per person or $250,000 per person will only have 5,000 of their donation going to Save America, sending hundreds of thousands of dollars to the RNC. Save America could use that money, Trump's Save America leadership PAC, the political committee that now functions primarily as his legal slush fund, reported paying lawyers, $5.6 million last month, according to FEC filings. That's well above the $5 million total the PAC raised in the same period. PAC ended the month with roughly $4 million in the bank. I mean, Brett, can you believe this? Trump said he wasn't going to take RNC money to pay his legal bills now, and now he's doing it. He's a liar. He's a hypocrite.
So good. It's a hostile takeover. These are the barbarians that got through the gate, my friends. Like, it's so funny that the RNC is like the business party, right? They're the ones of like business, and there should be an unfettered free market capitalism. And that's really what should govern how America works. That's the one thing they care about. They pretend to care about God and abortions and whatever, but they don't. They only care about money. And that exact ethos is what Trump employed to take over the party. People say like, I want the government to run like a business. Well, it is the Republican National Convention is now run like a business, but that business is run by the super shadiest businessman who just comes in and sucks everything out for himself. Like, this is what happens when the economy they want takes over their own party. Trump is essentially the vulture capitalist who is taking all the value out and using it for himself. And they're all going to start crying. And they were like, and the truth is at the end of it, they just don't have the power. Trump has the power. What they forgot to do as part of the RNC is be dynamic, as in the Republican politicians forgot to be entertaining and be engaging and be talented. And they got a guy that showed up and just stuck it to them, got people excited about being a Republican again. And he never was doing that to save America, make America great again. He was only doing that for himself. And the negative externality of that for the RNC is that the money's gonna go pay Trump's lawyers, because Trump is a charlatan and he is a convicted fraudster.
Yeah, well, he did try like cancer patients or people in bankruptcy to
cut his teeth. He cut his teeth on kids' charities.
Yeah, well, he did try the GoFundMe route, which is sadly a last resort for a lot of people, including Trump. But he felt just a little bit shy of his goal. He raised $1.8 million of the $355 million their target amount to pay off his judgment. But this week, his campaign sent out a new fundraising appeal. It goes on to say, "So before the day is over, I'm calling on 1 million pro-Trump patriots to chip in and say, stop the witch hunt against President Trump. All we need, it's an easy plan, Brett. We just need 1 million people to donate $355. I think they can do it."
I mean, I wouldn't put it past them. Like, that's so sad. This is by and large the same party whose constituents give every last dollar to, like, you know, a mega preacher. And this whole thing is not that different. The DNA of supporting Trump, a billionaire, to care about you is the same as like those prosperity gospel preachers who you give money to save you forever. I do want to show graphic 8 again. Is this the image that they chose to represent their GoFundMe? Like, instead of them looking defiant and proud, it just looks like they found, the photo looks like they just found out no one donated to the GoFundMe. Yeah, no one bought any muffins at
Trump
our big
sale. Trump is sad. Donate now.
It's so bad. It's tough. I don't like it when, you know, I think there's something weirdly karmic about me celebrating, you know, bad for my karma about me celebrating about someone hitting financial ruin. But I just don't have confidence that he'll ever actually pay the consequences. If he does, it'll be like, it won't feel real until much, much later. But this all seems like the road to Trump not being rich anymore.
Yeah, it is enjoyable, but he still might be president despite that, which is horrifying. We've got to take a break. Stick around. We've got more coming. You don't want to miss it. Welcome back. We've got a big update on the Georgia case. Let's get into it. Fulton DA Fannie Willis plans to press ahead with her goal of putting Trump on trial before the November election, and intends to ask the judge presiding over the Georgia criminal case to schedule a trial date as soon as this summer. This comes after she avoided being removed from the case due to her romantic relationship with lead prosecutor Nathan Wade. Here's what one ally of Willis said. Basically, this is a 2-month sideshow that the judge should have not even let happen. But it's over and the judge finally came to the right decision. And so now we're back to where we never should have left, which is these people were under felony indictment. Let's get a trial date. Sources close to Willis tell CNN that the DA's office is effectively ready to go to trial. Willis has said she needs only 30 days to prepare once a date is set. Defense attorneys have had since September to review the evidence and prepare their own arguments. Willis has previously asked for a trial to start in August 2024. Sources tell CNN she plans to re-up the request. This comes as Judge Scott McAfee gave Trump permission to appeal the ruling that kept Willis on the case. Fulton County Superior Court Judge McAfee granted a certificate of immediate review, citing Trump and his co-defendant's argument that McAfee's decision to keep Willis on the case is of such importance to the case that immediate review should be had. The defendants could not directly appeal McAfee's decision at this point in the case, so they had asked him to approve a certificate of immediate review, which would put the matter before an appeals court. The ruling gives the state court of appeals 45 days to decide whether to hear Trump's appeal of McAfee's order once the appeal is filed. The attorneys have 10 days to file that appeal. Trump attorney Steve Sadow called McAfee's decision highly significant, writing in a statement that the defense is optimistic that appellate review will lead to the case being dismissed and the DA being disqualified. The judge, McAfee, has indicated he is ready to continue moving forward, with sources familiar with the case saying he has asked attorneys on both sides about how to proceed with pretrial motions. While Willis wants to move forward, MAGA troll Marjorie Taylor Greene, she's back, wants to disbar her. She writes on Twitter, or X, the Everything app, "Today I'm filing a complaint to disbar Fulton County DA Fannie Willis for her corrupt actions. Fannie should have been removed from her political persecution of President Trump after it was revealed she went on lavish vacations with her lover, Nathan Wade, the lover she made hundreds of thousands of dollars, unfit to serve. Anyone is allowed to file a complaint against a lawyer practicing in Georgia. However, proceedings are confidential, so would not be made public if the Georgia State Bar decides to investigate or drop Green's complaint." Brett, love is under attack. Is that seems to be the issue here, right?
Yeah, that's what it's about. Listen, I think Fannie Willis has been not handling this super well, but like that said, the whole thing has been a sideshow. At the end, it shouldn't matter who Fannie is making wanton the night with. If she was smarter, she would definitely not have like had started up a relationship with someone on such a high profile case because of the opportunistic schmuckos out there. And then she would have handled her being her deposition or whatever it was, the court proceedings, the hearing, she would have handled it better than she did, which is, I don't see how anyone could watch that and be like, she did a great job. That said, like, get it back on track, guys. That we took the scenic route through the, oh, who's she banging and who's banging her? I've loved that scenic route when it's who's Trump banging, who's he paying cash money to. Those have been fun detours for me. So I'd be a hypocrite if I didn't say that those weren't entertaining. But okay, now we're back on track. Let's get it. Let's get back to if you guys really care about the rule of law, let's get in there. I just don't have any confidence. Like, Marjorie Taylor Greene is doing that thing where you start talking about the one thing you understood in the book. Like, all the rest of it, all the legal stuff is way over her head. What Trump did, didn't do, what this is about, she doesn't care. But she like saw that someone was banging someone else. So that's what she's going to harp on. Like, that's how dumb she is.
Yeah, I don't dismiss the impropriety of that relationship. I think it is a distraction, but also, like you're saying, on a case that high profile, you have to cross your T's and dot your I's.
Yeah.
You have to know that when you're going up against Trump and his team, they are going to look for everything they can to distract, to deflect, to undermine you. And you kind of gave them something big that was successful. Granted, it doesn't really matter. It's not really affecting the integrity of the case. It's more about her and her character. I don't even know if it's really improper if they're just dating. Like, you can date coworkers. It's like kind of weird, but I mean, imagine being married to your coworker. That would be weird, right?
Anyway, yeah, that'd be hell on earth.
Anyway, I don't think it's a big deal, but she did give them a golden egg that they ran with.
Right. That's the thing. It's just like, I said this on the show a couple of weeks ago, maybe last week, like prosecutors are politicians, and a lot of politicians are in it just for them. Now, the whole art of being a human in a society that has politicians is trying to line up the hubris that drives your politician with your political pressure to get them to do stuff so that they'll still stay a politician. I don't like George Gascon in Los Angeles. I think he's a charlatan D-bag, but that is proof that system works. Like, that guy used to be he was a police chief. He was if you like him now, you didn't like him when he was in San Francisco, when he was the reason that Colin Kaepernick started kneeling. And so a bunch of people jumped in and pressured him to change his ways and start doing things in the district attorney's office that was in line with their political goals. Fannie Willis, like, let's get it together. You know how high profile this case is. You can't do stuff like that. But you know, whatever has been happening has incentivized people to get Trump to be held accountable for trying to end democracy in America. This was like that weird glitch that she did something that was full of hubris and not the smartest. Now that that's been settled, she can get back to actually executing the democracy and the legal process that we need her to be in position for.
Well, let's get to our next story. It's an interesting one about how Republicans in Georgia are attacking unions. So they are continuing to prove that they don't care about what's good for American workers. GOP lawmakers in Georgia passed a bill on Wednesday to punish employers that make it easier for workers to form unions, sending the legislation to Republican Governor Brian Kemp for his signature. Senate Bill 362 would bar companies from receiving state economic incentives if they voluntarily recognize a union instead of requiring employees to vote in a secret ballot election. It is aimed at discouraging a process known as card check, whereby workers can unionize simply by showing there's majority support in the form of signed union cards. Although Kemp has indicated that he backs the legislation, it is likely to face legal challenges on the grounds that it conflicts with federal labor law. Republicans denied that the bill is anti-labor, saying it aims to protect workers' privacy. Some, including Kemp, argue that the secret ballot protects workers from being bullied into joining unions. Here's what State Rep. Sue Hong said. Nothing in the bill stops a union from being formed. We are ensuring that when the state invests state resources to drive job creation, that hardworking Georgians who hold those jobs have the agency to determine whether to be represented by a labor union. Governor Brian Kemp spoke out in favor of this bill back in January. Kemp proclaimed his support for the bill in a January speech to the Georgia Chamber of Commerce, echoing the chamber's own agenda. He said the move would protect workers' right to opportunity from President Joe Biden's pro-union agenda and outside forces who want nothing more than to see the free market brought to a screeching halt. Only 4.4% of Georgia workers are union members, the eighth lowest rate among states. This is a trend among Republican governors who are increasing their attacks on unions as well. South Carolina governor, our GOP governor, blasted labor unions while touting economic growth in his annual address. DeSantis leads Republican states' attacks against public sector unions. And you can see examples throughout the country, from Florida to Alaska, workers are facing legal efforts to weaken their power by targeting union certification and dues. Polling shows that the majority of Americans see the large reduction in the share of workers represented by unions over the past several decades as a bad thing for both the country and working people in the US. You can see here the total number of people, it's a net bad 54%. Brett, I want to bring you in here. What do you make of this? Do you think that this is really about workers having autonomy and a choice? Or is this about Biden's pro-labor agenda? What are they really doing here? Whose interests are they serving?
This is not about card check. There's plenty of reasons to have a discussion about whether card check versus secret ballot are the best way to go. Like that is a very valid discussion. Whether people get bullied all the time out of being in a union, right? That happens. You can't deny that it happens, right? But when that person from the Georgia state, whatever legislature says, listen, we're not anti-union at all. We're for worker privacy. That is bull. The entirety of this whole BS right to work legislation, right to work state movement that completely gutted the working class, specifically in the Rust Belt and all over and all the way down the South. Like they just want to keep wages low. They are just pro-corporation. They are just pro-business. That is all it is about. They want to take away, because a union is just a bargaining tactic. It is a bargaining technique. Decide to be in one, decide not to be in one based on what your objectives are. It is a tool. And so that the people in the Republican side of the aisle don't want you to ever have that tool. So they'll do the stuff that they do with abortion, where they're like, we're not against abortion. We're just going to make it so that we're going to make it hard to have an abortion clinic in your state. That's what this kind of legislation is. They make it harder for you to do the thing that they don't want you to do in the first place.
The pushback is partially because of some of the pro-union provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. They tried to push the PRO Act, which would have granted a bunch of new protections for unions and union organizing. They couldn't do that. Even they were just a couple senators short of those that had endorsed it. So between the Inflation Reduction Act and some other things through the National Labor Relations Board, there have been great advancements under the Biden administration for union organizing. Republicans see that and think, whoa, we can't let workers have too much power here. The corporations are going to lose control. So they're pushing back in this kind of a way and framing it as a worker choice or worker autonomy thing is ridiculous, because what they really want to do is undercut membership and people paying dues so that unions don't have power at all by saying, you should have a right not to join. Well, in some places you might still get the benefits, but you're just not paying dues into the union. No, you should chip in. You're getting those benefits and they bargain for you. You should chip in. So you saw that in places like Ohio. You saw that in places like Wisconsin. They really sought to undercut the membership. Oh, the Janus decision out of the Supreme Court was terrible on that front. But what they're trying to do is continue to chip away at union power and the ability to form a union, because they know deep down by letting workers have power, by letting workers collectively bargain, it's harder on corporations. It's harder on those Republican donors to maximize profits. That's what this is all about.
When it comes down to it, anyone, when they're deciding to join a union or not, think of it as a tool for negotiation. It's similar to in Hollywood, it's like, should I have an agent and a manager, or just an agent or a lawyer? Like, well, what do you want? And in that scenario, get what you want. And see, everything is a tool to get it. For a lot of people, traditionally in America, specifically in, when you're talking federal jobs, when you're talking major industries, a union can help you get there better, faster. And there's a lot of caveats along the way. There's a lot of ways you can leverage it on, use the union as unionization as like a looming way to say, like, let's get more stuff until we do the union. Like, there's a process, all the same way when you're negotiating any kind of contract. At the end of the day, the Republicans don't want you to even have that as an option, because they know the historical successes it's been able to get for people. The threat of it when you're entering a pre-unionization negotiation, and then the reality of it once you're in there and it's hard to fire people. Like, that's the kind of stuff that, like, they don't want you to have the tools. Meanwhile, those same legislators are creating more and more and more and more and more tools for the CEOs of the major corporations. They got rid of your weapon and they're just making more weapons for themselves in negotiations, whether it's through globalization, whether it's through trying to get subcontractors in different places, getting rid of workplace safety standards. Those are all the things. That is the meta description of the difference between traditionally the two parties when it comes to workplace negotiations.
Well, we could go on about this for way too long, but we have to take a break. Stick around, we've got more to come. Welcome back. Brett, I haven't been looking forward to this one since we started.
Me too.
I'm very excited about the story. Brett, are you worried about retirement?
Always. I watched some Dave Ramsey this morning.
Good. Well, what if I told you there is a new app that might boost your retirement portfolio?
Go on, Autopilot. Jordan.
Well, I'm about to tell you. Autopilot is an app that allows users to mimic trades made by members of Congress, and it has just exceeded $100 million in total investment. The app doesn't allow its users to mimic every member of Congress. Instead, it provides four legislators to copy: Representative Nancy Pelosi, Representative Dan Crenshaw, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, and Dan Goldman, plus an amalgam of stocks from the top 10 politician traders based on their 2022 performance. Statistics within the app show that Pelosi's reported trades increased 45% in value in 2023, and Crenshaw's increased in value by 41%. The app also allows you to copy trades made by Warren Buffett or Michael Burry of The Big Short fame. But if you really want to beat the market big, Congress might be where you want to look for guidance. The anonymous blogger Unusual Whales compiles an annual report of the top performing traders in Congress. And surprisingly, there are dozens of members of Congress who somehow beat the market. It's amazing. It remains a mystery why they remain in Congress when they could be working on Wall Street and making it big there. So here is just a snapshot of that annual report. You can see Brian Higgins, wow, what a guru, beat the market by 238.9%. Crazy, how does he do it? Mark Green, 122% return. This is impressive. Seth Moulton, 80%. Nancy Pelosi, 65.5% return. Look at this. This is incredible. They're amazing. And despite the app's success, the creators say that they hope the app pushes members of Congress to ban stock trading for themselves. They said, that's why we're doing this. Chris Josephs, the guy who created the app, said, honestly, it's partially to continue holding their feet to the fire. We're not going away. Brett, what do you think of this app? What do you think of this idea? Do you think it'll work?
This is the best thing I have ever seen. I think it will absolutely, it makes sense like it would work. And I can say just off the bat, we are not here to give any financial recommendations. This is an analysis of a news story. So do not take what we say. That said, go invest in this. No, I'm just kidding. So the S&P is the thing that it's all kind of pinned to. It's the yellow one in the thing. It was 24.8% yield. The S&P, that's just like 500 big companies that they just kind of do an average of. And that's where it goes in, the S&P trust or whatever. Relative to how the big companies are doing, these guys are beating the yield by 200%. And the argument is they're on the inside. They know they're not supposed to do any kind of insider trading, but Nancy Pelosi knows what kind of legislation they're going to pass. They know what kind of contractors they're going to get. And they know that maybe we should invest in those contractors. And to have an app that automatically does that for you, even if it's just a matter of like comparing for yourself to see how much like it actually works, I think that it's just wildly fascinating, and I'm very tempted to actually sign up for it.
I'm curious. I'm curious to see how it works. Michael Burry is also a fascinating one because he seems to be a very forward thinker about like crises that could be coming and aligning his investments that way. But the one thing I think this is a great example of why we need to ban stock trading for members of Congress, but also their family. Pelosi's defense has always been, oh, well, my husband Paul makes all the trades. Well, Paul must be some sort of savant. Same thing for like, I think Wyden and a couple others. Oh, well, my family, it's my family trust. They're doing all this. What? All of these people should have jobs on Wall Street. It's incredible. How do they know the market that well? But the one that really irks me, the example that really bothers me is when multiple members of Congress are trading and making trades, making investments or de-investments based on information they got early about coronavirus. I mean, that's millions worldwide dead as a result of that. And instead of warning people as early as possible about the severity, they went to check their investments, align their stocks accordingly. And then many of those same people then downplayed the severity of it, which they knew deep down was a big deal. And they aligned their investments accordingly. That's just heinous to me.
Yeah, it's so bad. What I like about this also as an app is that it, making it like no one knows how to make investments. They don't tell you. And I think that's the main difference between people in society. Like there's so much that we, you know, tilt against, so to speak, that we think is the difference between rich people and poor people. And the difference actually is that they tell rich people how the economy works. And then those folks teach their families about it. And then they keep winning. They know what a Roth IRA is and they don't tell anybody else about it. They leave you in as they're teaching you other stuff in school. But for this, it is very simple. This will help you invest based on what the people in Congress are doing. It's that simple. And I think that's what I like the most about it.
Let's get into our last story of the hour, and it's about Elon Musk. He's once again going out of his way to defend Twitter users who peddle racism and anti-Semitism. There are two parts to this. There's why he did it and what he did, but the former being the more disgusting part. Elon Musk's X changed its privacy policy this week to ban users from publishing the real names of people behind anonymous accounts after some users appeared to unmask a anonymous cartoonist, Stone Toss, who drew anti-Semitic images. The person behind the Stone Toss online comic was the subject of a report on March 12th by the Anonymous Comrades Collective, an anti-fascist research group. It said Stone Toss is the creation of a Texas man who works in IT, and it named him and his employer, as well as some documenting comments he made on podcasts and social media. This is normally where we might show you one of his cartoons as an example, but they were too offensive and we don't want to get the channel deleted. The cartoons by Stone Toss are extreme. One shows a Jewish man drinking the blood of an infant, which is a common anti-Semitic trope. Others use the deaths by suicide of transgender people as punchlines. Stone Toss put the cartoons on X, where they often attract millions of views. While we won't show you the originals, we will show you one that someone did remake and added his picture to it. There you can see that is his name and that is his picture. Since Elon has taken over Twitter, the application of rules around free speech and the use of suspensions has been inconsistent and seemingly only applied when they align with his personal views. Case in point, he suspended, but then reinstated journalists, podcasters, and leftist accounts who were critical of him. Some as soon as he took over, and then some recently. Ken Klippenstein, Rob Rousseau, a handful of others were part of a recent wave of bans over the past couple months. Many of them, if not all of them, had been critical of Musk. I mean, Brett, what do you make of the defense of this cartoonist, of the suspension over people like Jared Holt, Hannah Geis, people who are extremism researchers who just talked about this, getting suspended for even mentioning this guy's name?
It's the lack of consistency that proves the lack of any given value, any like consistent value system. He's so petulant. Elon Musk is such a baby boy when it comes to things like this. It is very obvious that it's not about the ideas. It's just about egomania, megalomania, and this sad sense of being so insecure that as much as he criticizes the essence of much social media, he's just a consumer of it with a lot of money and is able to buy a social media company that gives him what every sad, you know, and I fall victim to that sometimes too, what's every sad, insecure person wants, which is just likes. So everything he's doing isn't to save the world or create the marketplace of ideas. It's just so Elon Musk can have people that like him. And when you point out the inconsistencies and who he's banning and for what, and what he changes his privacy policy over, it just proves that that's the dynamic at play.
Yeah, I'm currently working through that book, Extremely Hardcore by Zoe Schiffer, about Elon's takeover of Twitter. And the recurring theme over everything that I've worked through so far is just there is no consistent ideology or thought behind any of this. They are completely at the whims of him and his mood. His ego. None of this is really consistent, and certainly none of this is about free speech. He's protecting people when it's convenient and it plays well with the right, because that's really his base now. That's it.
It's so sad. And like, I didn't want to admit it, but like, it really is a cesspool on Twitter. It's just become a horrible cesspool. It's not even useful anymore.
That's all the time we have today. Brett, thank you so much for joining me. Got anything to plug? An LP coming out with more Candace Owens songs?
Oh, I don't. I want to make that a more fleshed out musical work. Join me for Happy Half Hour next week. It's going to be a lot of fun. Wednesday at 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern at twitch.tv/TYT. I have a Rebel HQ video coming out this weekend that I was too sick to make, but I made it. And hopefully you'll enjoy it. So if you got 3.5 minutes, why don't you join me this Sunday on Rebel HQ?
Thank you again for joining me. And remember, stay safe out there. Stay sane out there.
I know the term because he stole it from Happy Half Hour. Stay safe out there. Stay sane out there. And we'll see you soon.